30. The grandma was, of course, a Adele. I called my in-laws. Guido answered coldly and put his wife on. Adele was cordial. She told me that Elsa was there and added, not only her.
The boys there too?
Yes.
Would you mind if I came to you?
We're expecting you. I had Enzo leave me at the station in Florence. The journey was complicated, with delays, waits, annoyances of every type. I thought about how Elsa, with her sly capriciousness, had ended up involving Adele. If Dede was incapable of deception, Elsa was at her best when it came to inventing strategies that could protect her and perhaps let her win. She had planned, it was clear, to impose Reno on me in the presence of her grandmother, a person who, she and her sister knew well, had been very unwilling to accept me as a daughter-in-law. For the entire journey, I felt relieved because I knew she was safe and hated her for the situation she was putting me in. I arrived in Genoa ready for a hard battle, but I found Adele very welcoming and Guido polite. As for Elsa, dressed for a party, heavily made up, on her wrist my mother's bracelet, and on full display the ring that years earlier her father had given me, she was affectionate and relaxed, as if she found it inconceivable that I could be mad at her. The only silent one, eyes perpetually downcast, was Reno, so that I felt sorry for him, and ended up more hostile toward my daughter than toward him. Maybe Enzo was right. The boy had had scant importance in that story. Of his mother's hardness, her insolence, he had no trace. It was Elsa who had dragged him along, beguiling him, and only to hurt Dede. The rare times he had the courage to look at me, his glances were those of a faithful dog. I quickly understood that Adele had received Elsa and Reno as a couple. They had their own room, their own towels. They slept together. Elsa had no trouble flaunting that intimacy authorized by her grandmother. Maybe she even accentuated it for me. When the two withdrew after dinner, holding hands, my mother-in-law tried to push me to confess my aversion for Reno. "She's a child," she said at a certain point. "I really don't know what she sees in that young man. She has to be helped to get out of it." I tried. I said, "He's a good kid, but even if he weren't, she's in love and there's little to be done." I thanked her for welcoming them with affection and broad-mindedness and went to bed. But I spent the whole night thinking about the situation. If I said the wrong thing, even just a wrong word, I would probably ruin both my daughters. I couldn't make a clean break between Elsa and Reno. I couldn't oblige the two sisters to live together at that impossible moment. What had happened was serious, and for a while, the two girls couldn't be under the same roof. To think of moving to another city would only complicate things. Elsa would make it her duty to stay with Reno. I quickly realized that if I wanted to take Elsa home and get her to graduate from high school, I would have to lose Dede, actually send her to live with her father. So the next day, instructed by Adele about the best time to call, she and her son, I discovered, talked to each other constantly. I talked to Pietro. His mother had informed him in detail about what had happened, and from his bad mood, I deduced that Adele's true feelings were certainly not what she showed me. Pietro said gravely, "We have to try to understand what sort of parents we've been and how we've failed our daughters."
"Are you saying that I haven't been and am not a good mother?"
"I'm saying that there is a need for continuity of affection and that neither you nor I have been able to ensure that Dede and Elsa have that."
I interrupted him, announcing that he would have a chance to be a full-time father to at least one of the girls. Dede wanted to go and live with him immediately. She would leave as soon as possible. He didn't take the news well. He was silent. He prevaricated. He said he was still adapting and needed time. I answered, "You know, Day-Day, you're identical. Even if you tell her no, you'll find her there." The same day, as soon as I had a chance to talk to Elsa alone, I confronted her, ignoring her blandishments. I had her give back the money, the jewelry, my mother's bracelet, which I immediately put on, stating, "You must never touch my things again." She was conciliatory. I wasn't. I hissed that I wouldn't hesitate for a moment to report first of all Reno, and then her. As soon as she tried to answer, I pushed her against a wall. I raised my hand to hit her. I must have had a terrible expression. She burst into terrified tears. "I hate you," she sobbed. "I don't ever want to see you again. I will never go back to that shitty place where you made us live." "All right, I'll leave you here for the summer, if your grandparents don't kick you out first." "And then?" "Then in September you'll come home. You'll go to school. You'll study. You'll live with Reno in our apartment until you've had enough of him." She stared at me, stunned. There was a long instant of incredulity. I had uttered those words as if they contained the most terrible punishment. She took them as a surprising gesture of generosity. "Really?" "Yes. I'll never have enough of him." "We'll see." "And Aunt Lena?" "Aunt Lena will agree." "I didn't want to hurt Day-Day, Mama. I love Reno. It happened."
"It will happen countless more times."
"It's not true."
"Worse for you. It means you'll love Reno your whole life."
"You're making fun of me."
I said no. I felt only all the absurdity of that verb in the mouth of a child. 31. I returned to the neighborhood. I told Leela what I had proposed to the children. It was a cold exchange, almost a negotiation.
"You'll have them in your house?"
"Yes."
"If it's all right with you, it's all right with me too."
"We'll split the expenses."
"I can pay it all."
"For now, I have money."
"For now, I do too."
"We're agreed then."
"How did Day-Day take it?"
"Fine. She's leaving in a couple of weeks. She's going to visit her father."
"Tell her to come and say goodbye."
"I don't think she will."
"Then tell her to say hello to Pietro for me."
"I'll do that."
Suddenly, I felt a great sorrow. I said,
"In just a few days, I've lost two daughters."
"Don't use that expression. You haven't lost anything. Rather, you've gained a son."
"It's you who pushed him in that direction."
She wrinkled her forehead. She seemed confused. "I don't know what you're talking about."
"You always have to incite, shove, poke.
Now you want to get mad at me too, for what your children get up to?"
I muttered, "I'm tired," and left.
For days, for weeks, in fact, I couldn't stop thinking that Leela couldn't bear the equilibrium in my life, and so aimed at disrupting it. It had always been so. But after Tina's disappearance, it had worsened. She made a move, observed the consequences, made another move. The objective? Maybe not even she knew. Of course, the relationship of the two sisters was ruined. Elsa was in terrible trouble. Day-Day was leaving. I would remain in the neighborhood for an indeterminate amount of time. 32. I was preoccupied with Day-Day's departure. Occasionally, I said to her, "Stay. You're making me very unhappy." She answered, "You have so many things to do, you won't even notice I'm gone." I insisted, "Ima adores you, and so does Elsa. You'll clear things up, it will pass." But Day-Day didn't want to hear her sister's name, As soon as I mentioned it, she assumed an expression of disgust and went out, slamming the door. A few nights before her departure, she suddenly grew very pale. We were having dinner, and began to tremble. She muttered, "I can't breathe." Ima quickly poured her a glass of water. Dede took a sip, then left her place and came to sit on my lap. It was something she had never done. She was big, taller than me. She had long since cut off even the slightest contact between our bodies. If by chance we touched, she sprang back as if by a force of repulsion. Her weight surprised me, her warmth, her full hips. I held her around the waist. She put her arms around my neck. She wept with deep sobs. Ima left her place at the table, came over, and tried to be included in the embrace. She must have thought that her sister wouldn't leave, and for the next days she was happy. She behaved as if everything had been put right. But Dede did leave. Rather, after that breakdown, she seemed tougher and more determined. With Ima, she was affectionate. She kissed her hundreds of times. She said, "I want at least one letter a week." She let me hug and kiss her, but without returning it. I hovered around her. I struggled to predict her every desire. It was useless. When I complained of her coldness, she said, "It's impossible to have a real relationship with you. The only things that count are work and Aunt Lena. There's nothing that's not swallowed up inside them. The real punishment for Elsa is to stay here. Bye, Mama." On the positive side, there was only the fact that she had gone back to calling her sister by name. 33. When, in early September of 1988, Elsa returned home, I hoped that her liveliness would drive out the impression that Leela really had managed to pull me down into her void. But it wasn't so. Reno's presence in the house, instead of giving new life to the rooms, made them bleak. He was an affectionate youth, completely submissive to Elsa and Ima, who treated him like their servant. I myself, I have to say, got into the habit of entrusting to him endless, boring tasks, mainly the long lines at the post office, which left me more time to work. But it depressed me to see that big, slow body around, available at the slightest nod, and yet moping, always obedient, except when it came to basic rules like remembering to raise the toilet seat when he peed, leaving the bathtub clean, not leaving his dirty socks and underwear on the floor. Elsa didn't lift a finger to improve the situation. Rather, she purposely complicated it. I didn't like her coy ways with Reno in front of Ima. I hated her performance as an uninhibited woman, when in fact she was a girl of 15. Above all, I couldn't bear the state in which she left the room where once she had slept with Dede, and which now she occupied with Reno. She got out of bed sleepily to go to school, had breakfast quickly, slipped away. After a while, Reno appeared, ate for an hour, shut himself in the bathroom for at least another half hour, got dressed, hung around, went out, picked up Elsa at school. When they got back, they ate cheerfully and immediately shut themselves in the room. That room was like a crime scene. Elsa didn't want me to touch anything. But neither of them bothered to open the windows or tidy up a little. I did it before Pinucha arrived. It annoyed me that she would smell the odor of sex, that she would find traces of their relations. Pinucha didn't like the situation. When it came to dresses, shoes, makeup, hairstyles, she admired what she called my modernity. But in this case, she let me understand quickly and in every possible way that I had made a decision that was too modern, an opinion that must have been widespread in the neighborhood. It was very unpleasant one morning to find her there, as I was trying to work, with a newspaper on which lay a condom, knotted so that the semen wouldn't spill. "I found it at the foot of the bed," she said, disgusted. I pretended it was nothing. "There's no need to show it to me," I remarked, continuing to type on the computer. "There's the wastebasket for that." In reality, I didn't know how to behave. At first, I thought that over time everything would improve. Every day there were clashes with Elsa, but I tried not to overdo it. I still felt wounded by Dede's departure and didn't want to lose her as well. So I went more and more often to Leela to say to her, "Tell Reno, he's a good boy. Try to explain that he has to be a little neater." But she seemed just to be waiting for my complaints to pick a quarrel. "Send him back here," she raged one morning. "Enough of that nonsense of staying at your house. Rather, let's do this. There's room. When your daughter wants to see him, she comes down, knocks, and sleeps here if she wants." I was annoyed. My child had to knock and ask if she could sleep with hers. I muttered, "No, it's fine like this." "If it's fine like this, what are we talking about?" I fumed. "Leela, I'm just asking you to talk to Reno. He's 24 years old. Tell him to behave like an adult. I don't want to be quarreling with Elsa continuously. I'm in danger of losing my temper and driving her out of the house."
"Then the problem is your child, not mine."
On those occasions, the tension rose rapidly, but had no outlet. She was sarcastic. I went home frustrated. One evening, we were having dinner when, from the stairs, her intransigent cry reached us. She wanted Reno to come to her immediately. He got agitated. Elsa offered to go with him. But as soon as Leela saw her, she said, "This is our business. Go home." My daughter returned sullenly, and meanwhile, downstairs, a violent quarrel erupted. Leela shouted. Enzo shouted. Reno shouted. I suffered for Elsa, who was anxiously wringing her hands. She said, "Mama, do something. What's happening? Why do they treat him like that?" I said nothing. I did nothing. The quarrel stopped. Some time passed. Reno didn't return. Elsa then insisted that I go see what had happened. I went down and Enzo, not Leela, opened the door. He was tired, depressed. He didn't invite me to come in. He said, "Leela told me that the boy doesn't behave well, so from now on he's staying here. Let me talk to her." I discussed it with Leela until late into the night. Enzo, gloomy, shut himself in another room. I understood almost immediately that she wanted to be thanked. She had intervened. She had taken back her son, had humiliated him. Now, she wanted me to say to her, "Your son is like a son of mine. It's fine with me that he's at my house, that he sleeps with Elsa. I won't come and complain anymore." I resisted for a long time. Then I gave in and brought Reno back to my house. As soon as we left the apartment, I heard her and Enzo start fighting again. 34. Reno was grateful.
"I owe you everything, Aunt Lenu. You're the best person I know, and I'll always love you."
"Reno, I'm not good at all. All you owe me is the favor of remembering that we have a single bathroom. And, besides Elsa, Ima and I also use that bathroom."
"You're right. I'm sorry. Sometimes I get distracted. I won't do it anymore."
He constantly apologized. He was constantly distracted. He was, in his way, in good faith. He declared endlessly that he wanted to find a job, that he wanted to contribute to the household expenses, that he would be very careful not to cause me trouble in any way, that he had an unbounded respect for me. But he didn't find a job, and life, in all the most dispiriting aspects of dailiness, continued as before, and perhaps worse. At any rate, I stopped going to Leela. I told her, "Everything's fine." It was becoming very clear to me that the tension between her and Enzo was increasing, and I didn't want to be the fuse for their rages. What had been upsetting me for a while was that the nature of their arguments had changed. In the past, Leela yelled, and Enzo, for the most part, was silent. But now it wasn't like that. She yelled, I often heard Tina's name, and her voice, filtered through the floor, seemed a kind of sick whine. Then suddenly Enzo exploded. He shouted, and his shouting extended into a tumultuous torrent of exasperated words, all in violent dialect. Leela was silent then. While Enzo shouted, she couldn't be heard. But as soon as he was silent, you could hear the door slam. I strained my ears for the shuffling of Leela on the stairs, in the entrance. Then her steps vanished in the sounds of the traffic on the Stradone. Enzo used to run after her, but now he didn't. I thought, maybe I should go down, talk to him, tell him, "You yourself told me how Leela continues to suffer. Be understanding." But I gave up and hoped that she would return soon. But she stayed away the whole day, and sometimes even the night. What was she doing? I imagined that she took refuge in some library, as Pietro had told me, or that she was wandering through Naples, noting every building, every church, every monument, every plaque. Or that she was combining the two things. First, she explored the city, then she dug around in books to find information. Overwhelmed by events, I had never had the wish or the time to mention that new mania, nor had she ever talked to me about it. But I knew how she could become obsessively focused when something interested her, and it didn't surprise me that she could dedicate so much time and energy to it. I thought about it with some concern only when her disappearances followed the shouting, and the shadow of Tina joined the one vanishing into the city, even at night. Then, the tunnels of Tufa under the city came to mind. The catacombs with rows of death's heads. The skulls of blackened bronze that led to the unhappy souls of the church of Purgatorio ad Arco. And sometimes I stayed awake until I heard the street door slam and her footsteps on the stairs. On one of those dark days, the police appeared. There had been a quarrel. She had left. I looked out at the window in alarm. I saw the police heading toward our building. I was frightened. I thought something had happened to Leela. I hurried onto the landing. The police were looking for Enzo. They had come to arrest him. I tried to intervene, to understand. I was rudely silenced. They took him away in handcuffs. As he went down the stairs, Enzo shouted to me in dialect, "When Leela gets back, tell her not to worry. It's a lot of nonsense." 35. For a long time, it was hard to know what he was accused of. Leela stopped being hostile toward him, gathered her strength, and concerned herself only with him. In that new ordeal, she was silent and determined. She became enraged only when she discovered that the state, since she had no official bond with Enzo, and furthermore had never been separated from Stefano, wouldn't grant her a status equivalent to a wife, or, as a result, the possibility of seeing him. She began to spend a lot of money, so that, through unofficial channels, he would feel her closeness and her support. Meanwhile, I went back to Nino. I knew from Marisa that it was useless to expect help from him. He wouldn't lift a finger even for his own father, his mother, his siblings. But with me, he again readily made an effort, maybe to make a good impression on Ima, maybe because it meant showing Leela, if indirectly, his power. Not even he, however, could understand precisely what Enzo's situation was, and at different times he gave me different versions that he himself admitted were not reliable. What had happened? It was certain that Nadia, in the course of her sobbing confessions, had mentioned Enzo's name. It was certain that she had dug up the period when Enzo, with Pasquale, had frequented the worker-student collective in Via dei Tribunali. It was certain that she had implicated them both in small demonstrations, carried out many years earlier against the property of NATO officials who lived in Via Manzoni. It was certain that the investigators were trying to involve Enzo, too, in many of the crimes that they had attributed to Pasquale. But at this point, certainties ended, and suppositions began. Maybe Nadia had claimed that Enzo had had recourse to Pasquale for crimes of a non-political nature. Maybe Nadia had claimed that some of those bloody acts, in particular the murder of Bruno Sicavo, had been carried out by Pasquale and planned by Enzo. Maybe Nadia had said she had learned from Pasquale himself that it was three men who killed the Solara brothers, him, Antonio Capuccio, Enzo Scano, childhood friends who, incited by a long-time solidarity and by an equally long-standing resentment, had committed that crime. They were complicated years. The order of the world in which we had grown up was dissolving. The old skills resulting from long study and knowledge of the correct political line suddenly seemed senseless. Anarchist, Marxist, Gramscian, Communist, Leninist, Trotskyite, Maoist, worker were quickly becoming obsolete labels, or, worse, a mark of brutality. The exploitation of man by man and the logic of maximum profit, which before had been considered an abomination, had returned to become the linchpins of freedom and democracy everywhere. Meanwhile, by means legal and illegal, all the accounts that remained open in the state and in the revolutionary organizations were being closed with a heavy hand. One might easily end up murdered or in jail. And among the common people, a stampede had begun. People like Nino, who had a seat in Parliament, and like Armando Galliani, who was now famous thanks to television, had intuited for a while that the climate was changing and had quickly adapted to the new season. As for those like Nadia, evidently they had been well advised and were cleansing their consciences by informing. But not people like Pasquale and Enzo. I imagined that they continued to think, to express themselves, to attack, to defend, resorting to watchwords they had learned in the 60s and 70s. In truth, Pasquale carried on his war even in prison, and to the servants of the state said not a word, either to implicate or to exonerate himself. Enzo, on the other hand, certainly talked. In his usual laborious way, weighing every word with care, he displayed his feelings as a communist, but at the same time denied all the charges that had been brought against him. Leela, for her part, focused her acute intelligence, her bad character, and very expensive lawyers on the battle to get him out of trouble. Enzo, a strategist? A combatant? And when, if he had been working for years, from morning to night, at basic sight? How would it have been possible to kill the Saladas with Antonio and Pasquale if he was in Avellino at the time, and Antonio was in Germany? Above all, even admitting that it was possible, the three friends were well known in the neighborhood, and masked or not, would have been recognized. But there was little to do. The wheels of justice, as they say, advanced. And at a certain point, I was afraid that Leela, too, would be arrested. Nadia named names upon names. They arrested some of those who had been part of the collective of Via dei Tribunali. One worked at the UN, one at the FAO, one was a bank employee. And even Armando's former wife, Isabella, a peaceful housewife married to a technician at Enel, got her turn. Nadia spared only two people, her brother and, in spite of widespread fears, Leela. Maybe the daughter of Professor Galliani thought that by involving Enzo, she had already struck her deeply. Or maybe she hated her and yet respected her, so that after much hesitation, she decided to keep her out of it. Or maybe she was afraid of her and feared a direct confrontation. But I prefer the hypothesis that she knew the story of Tina and took pity on her. Or, better still, she had thought that if a mother has an experience like that, there is nothing that can truly hurt her. Meanwhile, eventually, the charges against Enzo proved to be without substance. Justice lost its grip, got tired. After many months, very little remained standing. His old friendship with Pasquale, militancy in the worker-student committee in the days of San Giovanni a Tiduccio, the fact that the rundown farmhouse in the mountains of Cerino, the one where Pasquale had been hiding, was rented to one of his Avellinese relations. Step by judicial step, he who had been considered a dangerous leader, the planner and executor of savage crimes, was demoted to sympathizer with the armed struggle. When finally, even those sympathies proved to be generic opinions that had never been transmuted into criminal actions, Enzo returned home. But by then, almost 2 years had passed since his arrest, and in the neighborhood, a reputation as a terrorist who was much more dangerous than Pasquale Peluso had solidified around him. Pasquale, said people on the streets and in the shops, we've all known him since he was a child. He always worked. His only crime was that he was always an upright man who, even after the fall of the Berlin Wall, didn't shed the uniform of a communist his father sewed on him, who took on himself the sins of others and will never surrender. Enzo, on the other hand, they said, is very intelligent. He is well camouflaged by his silences and by the basic sight millions. Above all, he has behind him, directing him, Lina Cerullo, his black soul, more intelligent and more dangerous than he is. The two of them, yes, they must have done horrible things. Thus, as spiteful rumors accumulated, they were both marked out as people who not only had shed blood, but had been clever enough to get away with it. In that climate, their business, already in trouble because of Leela's indifference and the money she had spent on lawyers and other things, couldn't get going again. By mutual consent, they sold it. And although Enzo had often imagined that it was worth a billion lire, they barely got a couple of hundred million. In the spring of 1992, when they had stopped fighting, they separated, both as business partners and as a couple. Enzo left a good part of the money to Leela and went to look for work in Milan. To me, he said one afternoon, "Stay near her. She's a woman who isn't comfortable with herself. She'll have a hard old age." For a while, he wrote regularly. I did the same. A couple of times he called me. Then that was all. 36. More or less around the same time, another couple broke up, Elsa and Reno. Their love and complicity lasted for 5 or 6 months, at which point my daughter took me aside and confided that she felt attracted to a young mathematics teacher, a teacher in another section who didn't even know of her existence. I asked, "And Reno?" She answered,
He is my great love.
I understood, as she added jokes to sighs, that she was making a distinction between love and attraction, and that her love for Reno wasn't affected in the least by her attraction to the teacher. Since I was, as usual, stressed, I was writing a lot, publishing a lot, traveling a lot. It was Ima who became the confidant of both Elsa and Reno. My youngest daughter, who respected the feelings of both, gained the trust of both, and became a reliable source of information for me. I learned from her that Elsa had succeeded in her intention of seducing the professor. I learned from her that Reno had eventually begun to suspect that things with Elsa weren't going well. I learned from her that Elsa had abandoned the professor so that Reno wouldn't suffer. I learned from her that, after a break of a month, she had started up again. I learned from her that Reno, suffering for almost a year, finally confronted her, weeping, and begged her to tell him if she still loved him. I learned from her that Elsa had shouted at him, "I don't love you anymore, I love someone else." I learned from her that Reno had slapped her, but only with his fingertips, just to show he was a man. I learned from her that Elsa had run to the kitchen, grabbed the broom, and beat him furiously, with no reaction from him. From Leela, however, I learned that Reno, when I was absent and Elsa didn't come home from school and stayed out all night, had gone to her in despair. "Pay some attention to your daughter," she said one evening. "Try to understand what she wants." But she said it indifferently, without concern for Elsa's future or for Reno's. In fact, she added, "Besides, look, if you have your commitments and you don't want to do anything, it's all right just the same." Then she muttered, "We weren't made for children." I wanted to respond that I felt I was a good mother and wore myself out trying to do my work without taking anything away from Dede, Elsa, and Ima. But I didn't. I perceived that at that moment she wasn't angry with me or my daughter. She was only trying to make her own indifference toward Reno seem normal. Things were different when Elsa left the professor and began going out with a classmate with whom she was studying for her final exams. She told Reno right away so that he would understand that it was over. Leela then came up to my house and, taking advantage of the fact that I was in Turin, made an ugly scene. "What did your mother put in your head?" she said in dialect. "You have no sensitivity. You hurt people and don't realize it." Then she yelled at her, "My dear, you think you're so important, but you're a whore." Or at least Elsa reported that, entirely confirmed by Ima, who said to me, "It's true, Mama. She called her a whore." Whatever Leela had said, my second daughter was marked by it. She lost her lightness. She also gave up the schoolmate she was studying with and became nice to Reno. But she left him alone in the bed and moved to Ima's room. When the exams were over, she decided to visit her father and Dede, even though Dede had never given any sign of wanting to reconcile with her. She left for Boston, and there, the two sisters, helped by Pietro, agreed on the fact that being in love with Reno had been a mistake. Once they made peace, they had a good time traveling around the United States, and when Elsa returned to Naples, she seemed more serene. But she didn't stay with me for long. She enrolled in physics. She became frivolous and sharp again. She changed boyfriends frequently. Since she was pursued by her schoolmate, by the young mathematics teacher, and naturally by Reno, she didn't take her exams, returned to her old loves, mixed them with new ones, accomplished nothing. Finally, she flew off again to the United States, having decided to study there. She, like Dede, left without saying goodbye to Leela, but completely unexpectedly, she spoke of her positively. She said that she understood why I had been her friend for so many years, and, without irony, called her the best person she had ever known. 37. That was not Reno's opinion, however. Elsa's departure did not stop him,
surprising as it may seem, from continuing to live with me.
He was in despair for a long time, afraid of falling again into the physical and moral wretchedness from which I had rescued him. Full of devotion, he attributed that and many other virtues to me, and he continued to occupy the room that had been Dede and Elsa's. He naturally did many jobs for me. When I left, he drove me to the station and carried my suitcase. When I returned, he did the same. He became my driver, my errand boy, my factotum. If he needed money, he asked me for it politely, affectionately, and without the least scruple. At times, when he made me nervous, I reminded him that he had some obligations toward his mother. He understood and disappeared for a while. But sooner or later he returned discouraged, muttering that Leela was never home, that the empty apartment made him sad. Or he grumbled, "She didn't even say hello. She sits at her computer and writes." Leela was writing? What was she writing? My curiosity at first was faint, the equivalent of an absent-minded observation. I was nearly 50 at the time. I was in the period of my greatest success. I was publishing 2 books a year and selling well. Reading and writing had become a career, and like all careers, it began to burden me. I remember thinking, in her place, I'd sit on a beach in the sun. Then I said to myself, if writing helps her, good. And I went on to something else. I forgot about it. 38. Dede's departure and then Elsa's grieved me. It depressed me that both, in the end, preferred their father to me. Of course they loved me. Of course they missed me. I sent letters constantly. At moments of melancholy, I telephoned without caring about the expense. And I liked Dede's voice when she said, "I dream of you often." How moved I was if Elsa wrote, "I'm looking everywhere for your perfume. I want to use it too." But the fact was that they were gone. I had lost them. Every letter of theirs, every telephone call attested to the fact that, even if they suffered because of our separation, with their father, they didn't have the conflicts they had had with me. He was the point of entry to their true world. One morning, Leela said to me in a tone that was hard to decipher, "It makes no sense for you to keep Ima here in the neighborhood. Send her to Rome, to Nino. It's very clear that she wants to be able to say to her sisters, 'I've done what you did.'" Those words had an unpleasant effect on me. As if she were giving dispassionate advice, she was suggesting that I separate also from my third child. She seemed to be saying, "Ima would be better off, and so would you." I replied, "If Ima leaves me too, my life will no longer have meaning." But she smiled. "Where is it written that lives should have a meaning?" So she began to disparage all that struggle of mine to write. She said mockingly, "Is the meaning that line of black markings that look like insect shit?" She invited me to take a rest. She exclaimed, "What need is there to work so hard? Enough." I had a long period of uneasiness. On the one hand, I thought, she wants to deprive me of Ima too. On the other, I said to myself, she's right. I should bring Ima and her father together. I didn't know whether to cling to the affection of the only child who remained, or, for her sake, to try to reinforce her bond with Nino. This last was not easy, and the recent elections had been proof of it. Ima was 11, but she was inflamed by political passion. She wrote, I remember, to her father. She called him. She offered in every possible way to campaign for him and wanted me to help him, too. I hated the socialists even more than in the past. When I saw Nino, I'd made remarks like, "What's become of you? I no longer recognize you." I went so far as to say, with some rhetorical exaggeration, "We were born in poverty and violence. The Saladas were criminals who stole everything. But you are worse. You are gangs of looters who make laws against the looting of others." He had answered lightheartedly, "You've never understood anything about politics, and you never will understand anything. Play with literature, and don't talk about things you don't know about." But then the situation came to a head. Long-standing corruption, commonly practiced and commonly submitted to at every level as an unwritten rule, but always in force among the most widely respected, came to the surface thanks to a sudden determination of the judiciary. The high-level crooks, who at first seemed few and so inexperienced that they were caught with their hands in the till, multiplied, became the true face of the management of the republic. As the elections approached, I saw that Nino was less carefree. Since I had my fame and a certain reputation, he used Ima to ask me to stand behind him publicly. I said yes to the child in order not to upset her, but then, in fact, I withdrew. Ima was angry. She repeated her support for her father, and when he asked her to stand next to him in a campaign ad, she was enthusiastic. I rebelled and found myself in a terrible situation. On the one hand, I didn't refuse Ima permission. It would have been impossible without a rift. On the other, I scolded Nino on the telephone. "Put Albertino, put Lydia in your ad, and don't dare use my daughter in this way." He insisted. He hesitated. Finally, he gave in. I forced him to tell Ima that he had inquired and that children weren't allowed in the ads. But she understood that I was the reason she had been deprived of the pleasure of standing publicly next to her father, and she said, "You don't love me, Mama. You sent Dede and Elsa to Pietro, but I can't even spend 5 minutes with Papa." When Nino wasn't reelected, Ima began to cry. She muttered between her sobs that it was my fault. In other words, it was all complicated. Nino was bitter. He became intractable. For a while, he seemed to be the only victim of those elections, but it wasn't so. Soon the entire system of the parties was swept away, and we lost track of him. The voters were angry with the old, the new, and the very new. If people had been horrified at those who wanted to overthrow the state, now they were disgusted by those who, pretending to serve it, had consumed it, like a fat worm in the apple. A black wave, which had lain hidden under gaudy trappings of power and a flow of words as impudent as it was arrogant, became increasingly visible and spread to every corner of Italy. The neighborhood of my childhood wasn't the only place untouched by any grace. Naples wasn't the only irredeemable city. I met Leela on the stairs one morning. She seemed cheerful. She showed me the copy of the Repubblica she had just bought. There was a photograph of Professor Guido Airota. The photographer had caught on his face, I don't know when, a frightened expression that made him almost unrecognizable. The article, full of they-says and perhapses, advanced the hypothesis that even the prestigious scholar, not to mention old political operator, might soon be summoned by the judges as one who was well informed about the corruption of Italy. 39. Guido Airota never appeared before the judges, but for days, dailies and weeklies drew maps of corruption in which even he played a part. I was glad in that situation that Pietro was in America, that Dede and Elsa too now had a life on the other side of the ocean. But I was worried about Adele. I thought I should at least telephone her. But I hesitated. I said to myself, she'll think that I'm enjoying it, and it will be hard to convince her it's not true. Instead, I called Maria Rosa. It seemed to me an easier path to take. I was wrong. It was years since I'd seen or spoken to her. She answered coldly. She said, with a note of sarcasm, "What a career you've had, my dear. Now you're read everywhere. One can't open a newspaper or a journal without finding your name." Then she spoke in detail about herself, something she had never done in the past. She cited books, she cited articles, she cited travels. It struck me, mainly, that she had left the university. "Why?" I asked. It disgusted me. "And now? Now what? How do you live?" "I have a rich family." But she regretted that phrase as soon as she uttered it. She laughed uneasily, and it was she, right afterward, who spoke of her father. She said, "It was bound to happen." And she quoted Franco. She said that he had been among the first to understand that either everything would change, and in a hurry, or even harder times would come, and there would be no more hope. She was angry. "My father thought you could change one thing here and one thing there, deliberately. But when you change almost nothing like that, you're forced to enter into the system of lies, and either you tell them, like the others, or they get rid of you." I asked her, "Guido is guilty? He took money?" She laughed nervously. "Yes, but he is entirely innocent. In his whole life, he never put a single lira that wasn't more than legal in his pocket." Then she turned again to me, but in an almost offensive tone. She repeated, "You write too much. You no longer surprise me." And although I had been the one to call, it was she who said goodbye and hung up. The incongruous double judgment that Maria Rosa had pronounced on her father was true. The media storm around Guido slowly faded and he returned to his study. But as an innocent who surely was guilty, and, if you like, as a guilty man who surely was innocent, it seemed to me that at that point I could telephone Adele. She thanked me, ironically, for my concern, showed that she was better informed than I was regarding the life and studies of Dede and Elsa, uttered remarks like, "This is a country where one is exposed to every insult. Respectable people should be in a hurry to emigrate." When I asked if I could say hello to Guido, she said, "I'll say it for you. He's resting now." Then she exclaimed bitterly, "His only crime was to be surrounded by newly literate types with no ethics. Young arrivists ready for anything. Scum." That very evening, the television showed a particularly cheerful image of the former socialist deputy Giovanni Sartori, who was not exactly a youth at the time, he was 50, and inserted him in the increasingly crowded list of corruptors and corrupt. 40. That news especially upset Ima. In those first years of her conscious life, she had seen her father very little, and yet had made him her idol. She boasted of him to her schoolmates. She boasted to her teachers. She showed everyone a photograph from the newspapers, in which they were hand in hand, right at the entrance to Montecitorio. If she had to imagine the man she would marry, she said, "He will surely be very tall, dark, and handsome." When she learned that her father had ended up in jail like an ordinary inhabitant of the neighborhood, a place that she considered horrible, Now that she was growing up, she said in no uncertain terms that she was afraid of it, and increasingly, she had reason to be. She lost the bit of serenity I had been able to guarantee her. She sobbed in her sleep. She woke in the middle of the night and wanted to get in bed with me. Once we met Marisa, worn out, shabby, angrier than usual. She said, paying no attention to Ima, "Nino deserves it. He's always thought only of himself, and, as you well know, he never wanted to give us any help. He acted like an honest man only with his relatives, that piece of shit." My daughter couldn't bear even a word of it. She left us on the stradone and ran away. I quickly said goodbye to Marisa. I chased after Ima. I tried to console her. "You mustn't pay any attention. Your father and his sister never got along." But I stopped speaking critically of Nino in front of her. In fact, I stopped speaking critically of him in front of anyone. I remembered when I went to him to find out about Pasquale and Enzo. You always needed some patron saint in paradise to navigate the calculated opacity of the underworld. And Nino, although far from any sanctity, had helped me. Now that the saints were falling into the inferno, I had no one to ask to find out about him. Unreliable news came to me only from the infernal circle of his many lawyers. 41. Leela, I have to say, never showed any interest in Nino's fate. She reacted to the news of his legal troubles as if it were something to laugh about. She said, with the expression of someone who has remembered a detail that explained everything, "Whenever he needed money, he got Bruno Sicavo to give it to him, and he certainly never paid it back." Then she muttered that she could imagine what had happened to him. He had smiled. He had shaken hands. He had felt he was the best of all. He had continuously wanted to demonstrate that he was equal to any possible situation. If he had done something wrong, he had done it out of a desire to be more likable, to seem the most intelligent, to climb higher and higher. That's it. And later, she acted as if Nino no longer existed. As much as she had exerted herself for Pasquale and Enzo, so she appeared completely indifferent to the problems of the former Honorable Saratore. It's likely that she followed the proceedings in the papers and on television, where Nino appeared often pale, suddenly grizzled, with the expression of a child who says, "I swear it wasn't me." Certainly she never asked me what I knew about him, if I had managed to see him, what he expected, how his father, his mother, his siblings had reacted. Instead, for no clear reason, her interest in Ima was rekindled. She got involved with her again. While she had abandoned her son Reno to me like a puppy who, having grown fond of another mistress, no longer greets the old one, she became very attached to my daughter again, and Ima, always greedy for affection, went back to loving her. I saw them talking, and they often went out together. Leela said to me, "I showed her the botanic garden, the museum, Capo di Monte." In the last phase of our life in Naples, she guided Ima all over the city, transmitting an interest in it that remained with her. "Aunt Lena knows so many things," Ima said in admiration. And I was pleased because Leela, taking her around on her wanderings, managed to diminish her anguish about her father, the anger at the fierce insults of her classmates prompted by their parents, and the loss of the attention she had received from her teachers, thanks to her surname. But it wasn't only that. I learned from Ima's reports, and with greater and greater precision, that the object in which Leela's mind was engaged, and on which she was writing for perhaps hours and hours, bent over her computer, was not this or that monument, but Naples in its entirety. An enormous project that she had never talked to me about. The time had passed in which she tended to involve me in her past.